This is a recording from the Jefferson Society at the University of Virginia. On October 12, 2007, Mr. Nicholas Johnson, chief scientist for orbital debris at NASA, gave the Society an update on exactly what's up there beyond the atmosphere.
I also like to thank the Jefferson Society for inviting me here, giving this opportunity to talk with you a little bit about orbital debris, probably more than you ever wanted to know. And also some of the non-technical issues that anyone might experience. When you think about policy, whether it's domestic policy or international policy, you know, you're normally talking about political science majors or diplomats. But for technical policies, be they, again, domestic or international policies, you have to have a strong foundation in the sciences. And if you're an undergraduate or a graduate and you're in science or engineering, the farthest thing from your mind is, well, I've got to go work at an international level to develop policy. And in fact, someone has to do that. I have no training in political science, but there's a tremendous thing called on-the-job training. And you pick it up, and it's important because my personal experience is that you need technical subject experts to be able to develop both domestic technical policies and international technical policies. You can't leave it only to the diplomats. So what I'd like to do first is take you a little tour around our planet. This is a depiction from very far out of the Earth and all the man-made objects around it. We're currently tracking, the United States is currently tracking about 15,000 objects, of which only about 800 are operational spacecraft. So everything else is debris. And we're seeing right now a view from far off. This ring is the geosynchronous orbit where most of the communication satellites are and a few other application satellites at an altitude of about 20,000 miles. The majority of debris is all centered what we call in low Earth orbit, which is below 2,000 kilometers. And you can't see it down here, but it looks great on my laptop. All right, this is what the satellite population looked like in 1960, 1965, 1970. You'll see the population growing. Again, roughly 95% of everything you see is debris. Old spacecraft, rocket bodies, pieces of satellites and rocket bodies which have blown up. You see it increasing. Again, this is low Earth orbit. Again, within about 2,000 kilometers from the surface of the Earth. This is a farther away view. There's satellites which go high over the North Pole and not in the South Pole. 2005, and then actually from 2005 to now, this year, there's a tremendous increase, which I'll talk about in just a minute, even more so than the past. So what we have is a classic environmental problem, pollution, if you will, not unlike air pollution, water pollution, but it's one actually that we recognized now many years ago. And the one caveat here is that these dots make it look like it's very, very cluttered. Clearly, the dots which represent each of these satellites that we're tracking can't be to scale to the same size of the Earth. So it looks like it's much more densely populated than it is. But it's a large number. And the issue is that the number is growing and will continue to grow. And the probability of interactions, accidents between spacecraft obviously continues to grow as well. You get the next one? You know your topic has made the big time when you're in Frank and Ernest. And so as you can see, twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder who you are. You don't know what it is. The sky is so filled with man's debris, it's hard to tell just what I see. And that's pretty much the way it is. In fact, a lot of astronomers will tell you that. They worry and they complain about pollution from satellites because satellites are always contaminating their photographs of stars and galaxies. If you go to the next one. So again, what is orbital debris? Prior to the space age, 50 years ago, the only object in orbit about the Earth was the moon. Everything else in orbit about the Earth is man-made. And again, has been growing at a relatively linear rate. Meteoroids are in orbit about the sun, and the Earth passes through those streams, and they impact the Earth, and you see them as shooting stars. But everything in orbit, so when we talk about orbital debris, we're talking about man-made debris. Next. All right, I'd like to step back just a minute before I talk more about orbital debris. This is a cartoon which appeared in the Chicago Tribune in 1978. This is the year after the first Star Wars movie, which was certainly before most of your time. And it was the beginning of serious negotiations between the United States and the former Soviet Union on anti-satellite weapons in space. The history had been that the United States and the Soviet Union both had rudimentary anti-satellite systems up until 1972. And in 1972, we signed the ABM Treaty, and it was the beginning of the age of detente. And a lot of systems were either decommissioned or allowed to become ineffective. And we started a negotiations with the Soviets just after 1976, when the Soviets started testing their anti-satellite system again. And of course, you recognize the handsome gentleman on the right in the middle. Go to the next one. So my beginning with orbital debris actually came on the other side of the coin. The Carter administration initiated a anti-satellite program to counteract the Soviet anti-satellite program. And we devised a system which actually was very innovative at the time, called an air-launch anti-satellite. And it literally was simply a missile which dropped off an F-15 airplane, and that missile flew up and dropped off the little circular object, which is called a miniature vehicle. It has no explosives on it, but it simply rammed into the spacecraft going at several kilometers per second, and that was enough to destroy it. So the key here was actually to create hundreds or thousands of pieces of debris of the enemy satellite. And I was what was called a threat analyst. I was an expert on Soviet space systems. And so part of my job was to first find out what the vulnerabilities were to see how well the U.S. system would work against Soviet satellites. And then during war games, it was my job to pretend I was a Soviet and try to evade or diminish the ability of the United States to destroy the satellite. So I would develop a countermeasure and then go back to my colleagues with the blue hats on and try to come up with countermeasures. So again, what you'd like to see, if you're a commander over naval forces or ground forces, you'd like to see a target that you're engaging develop into lots of pieces. You're then relatively convinced that it's dead and no longer a threat to you. Well, the Soviets also had a satellite system, anti-satellite system, which they had developed in the 1960s and then had started testing again in 1976 and later. And it was a little bit different. It was a ground launch, so it went up on a conventional missile from a fixed launch site. And then it would circle the Earth once or twice, so about an hour and a half or 3 hours, before it would intercept its target, which obviously would be a U.S. satellite. And what it would do when it got close, this is a target satellite down here, when it got close, it actually had something so simple as what amounts to a pellet warhead. And it would, like a shotgun, it would fire this warhead, and supposedly, if you were good, enough pellets would hit the target and destroy it. Well, when it fired the warhead, the spacecraft itself actually broke up into typically several dozens of pieces. And these pieces were large enough that we could track them with ground-based radars. And so we knew what was going on. But the pellets themselves were very, very small. And we could never track them by ground-based sensors. But I asked the question one day of what happened to the pellets that no one else apparently had ever asked. And the answer actually was very, very interesting. And this was in the early 1980s. And I took that answer to NASA. It was my first official interaction with NASA in this kind of capacity. And it turned out to be a very, very interesting answer. It turns out some of those pellets did remain in orbit. And where they were was important. So let me now go back and talk a little bit more about orbital debris. I said we're tracking about 15,000 objects. Some of them are tens of meters in diameter. We can see things from the ground down to 1 to 2 millimeters. So like a tenth of an inch we can detect with ground-based radars. Now, the question is, how important are these? This is the potential damage to the U.S. shuttle. If I have a particle here which is about 1 millimeter, which is a fraction of a tenth of an inch, then that's sufficient to penetrate what we call the RCC, the leading edge of the wings on the shuttle, which is important for reentry. The problem with the Columbia space shuttle was a fault in that RCC caused not by orbital debris, but by foam from the external tank on launch. If you get to larger pieces, then we can have much, much greater damage. And these are the pieces that we can track with these radars, ground-based radars, and we can avoid. We actually look on a constant basis 3 days in advance when the shuttle is flying and currently now when the space station is flying and try to avoid the larger pieces of debris. Smaller pieces of debris below 1 millimeter will cause damage on spacecraft, but it's usually not catastrophic or not mission-limiting. Let's go to the next one. For example, this is a picture of the Hubble Space Telescope as it's being serviced. Actually, this is one of the early servicing missions. You remember the infamous problem with the mirror on Hubble. We had to go up and put corrective lenses on it. When we went up there for the very first time, we found what turned out to be a relatively large hole in this antenna. This is the antenna right here. It's a high-gain antenna which transmit the spectacular photos that you see from Hubble. And it runs about 3/4 inch in diameter across the hole. Almost certainly was caused by orbital debris. We didn't even know it had happened when we got there because it didn't affect the operation of the antenna, which was certainly a good thing. Next. But once you get closer to the Hubble Space Telescope, and here's an astronaut on EVA, and you can see here's a point of an impact feature, and this is that feature blown up. So just like a little miniature BB hitting at high speed, not unlike, for example, a small crater on your windshield when you get hit by a pebble or something as you're going down the freeway. And in fact, by looking at the Hubble Space Telescope, we see these things all over. It's being hit by this every single day. But most of these, in fact, all of these impacts have no effect on the operation of the spacecraft, which is a good thing. Here's an example of a solar array which we brought back from the Mir space station. Again, you have an entry wound here. Looks just like a bullet impact. And here's the exit wound coming out the back side. These particles are typically traveling at about 7 miles per second when they hit the solar array. Next. This is the International Space Station. This is its current configuration. Hopefully, we have a new mission later this month. We'll be adding another solar array right over here. But this is some of the data, some of the damage we've already seen. This was a tear in a blanket we discovered this summer. Ironically, as astronauts were outside putting additional orbital debris shielding on the Russian portion of the space station. We've got holes in radiators here. Holes in solar arrays. This is part of a logistics module which we take up to carry cargo to the space station, leave for about a week and bring back. And even though it was only up for a week, it got a good size hole in it. Again, fortunately, this is all relatively minor damage. The space station is the most heavily protected vehicle ever launched. It can withstand impacts of debris up to about 1 centimeter. Next. All right. Your space shuttle, we've had holes in the radiators. These are potentially mission-threatening. If one of the holes would penetrate one of the tubes under the radiators, then we lose thermal control and the vehicle would have to actually come back very rapidly to be able to save the crew. The windows, we have, as you know, several small windows around the front of the crew and on top of the vehicle. We wind up replacing about 2 windows per mission because they're getting hit by very, very small particles. These are very, very microscopic particles. We have replaced a lot of windows. They have this kind of feature, again, like the windshield in your car, that are literally flecks of paint that have come off other satellites. This is a problem we never even envisioned until we started to fly the shuttle. Every satellite which is launched is painted for thermal control reasons. And we never thought too much about it, but think about what does your house look like after 10 or 15 years? The paint starts to peel. Well, it's even worse in space. And so all those painted spacecraft we've launched have all started to peel, and those little particles are floating around, but hitting at 5 miles per second or 7 miles per second, they can cause substantial damage. Not that it threatens the crew survival on reentry, but we do have to replace those windows prior to the next launch. Here's an animation of a Soviet upper stage, which blew up in February this year. It's actually the worst accidental explosion ever experienced in the 50 years of space flight. It had been launched a year earlier, but had malfunctioned, and left on board were a couple of tons of propellant that had never been burned. And all it took was a year later for that propellant to self-induce into an explosion, and just by happenstance, some astronomers in Australia were able to catch this debris cloud. This is the main particle, the main spacecraft, or in this stage, upper stage, and here's a debris cloud going along with it soon after the explosion. We've identified over 200 breakups of spacecraft and upper stages over the last 45 years. And that's created the vast majority of the debris which is out there now, certainly all the hazardous debris. For 10 years, I was on call 24/7 to evaluate after every accident that occurs to make sure that there's no undue risk to the space shuttle, the International Space Station, or other valuable U.S. space assets. And these things, kind of like mothers giving birth, typically happen at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And you'd have to then go out and make an assessment to make sure that it was safe. In fact, my very first day with NASA, we experienced a U.S. upper stage breakup, which was the worst to that date. Over 700 particles, which we could track from the ground, were created. And unfortunately, it happened just about 10, 15 miles above the Hubble Space Telescope, which we couldn't do much about the Hubble, but we were planning a new shuttle mission to go service the Hubble. And so one of my first jobs at NASA was to make an evaluation of whether or not it was even safe to fly the shuttle, because we were going to go into the largest debris cloud that we had ever seen. There was another incident on the day before Thanksgiving in 2001. There was another explosion of a Russian spacecraft just above the International Space Station. So our first concern, of course, was, is the International Space Station safe? And we made a quick evaluation and determined that there was no immediate risk to the space station. But again, we were planning a shuttle mission the very next week. The shuttle is much more vulnerable to orbital debris than is the space station due to its nature of having to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. So it can't have the shielding that the International Space Station has. And so we had to spend the entire Thanksgiving weekend and into the early part of the next week to convince ourselves that it was still safe to fly the space shuttle on that particular mission. Not only were we flying up to the space station near the cloud, we were also going to be doing an EVA, so that during a spacewalk, when you have crew people out, they are even more vulnerable to orbital debris because of the nature of their suits. And we were going to be boosting up the space station to a higher altitude, which would again make it even closer to the heart of the debris cloud. So these things happen, unfortunately, way too often. Next slide, please. And one of the things that we've seen now, and this is the real concern for the future, is that we now have sufficient material in space, enough large objects that they are going to start running into each other. And in fact, it's already happened on at least 3 occasions that we've been able to identify. Fortunately, none of these 3 events to date have led to large debris clouds being generated, but that is going to happen. It's an eventuality. There's nothing we can do about it unless we could somehow remove these old spacecraft and rockets from their orbits, which we currently at this point have no possibility of doing. So the second bullet, in the future, accidental collisions are going to be the primary source. If we were to never launch another spacecraft throughout the world, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, we would start to see the debris population start to increase again anyway, because existing spacecraft are going to start running into each other and creating debris faster than they'll fall back to Earth naturally. So what NASA did in 1995, was to create a list of some very simple, we call orbital debris mitigation guidelines, where we tackled the most important things first, and the easiest things as well, and things we could practically implement. So the first thing we wanted to make sure is not to create unnecessary debris. In the old days, in the 1960s and 1970s, you know, we would have lens covers on sensors, and we'd get on orbit, we'd just throw the lens cover away because we didn't need it anymore, and then we didn't worry about it. We did a lot of other things. We used to have attachment, you know, lanyards and clamp bands that we would simply throw off needlessly, but we didn't think too much about it. Again, a classic situation of any pollution problem. This is how it gets started. You're not thinking ahead into what the effect of your actions are on the environment. The second one, which is the very most important, was to prevent both accidental and deliberate explosions, because that, again, is the source of the worst debris which we currently have in Earth orbit. And then after we do that, we want to make sure that we could dispose of spacecraft and launch vehicle upper stages in an appropriate manner. Well, I just said that if you leave them in orbit, they're going to eventually collide. So we came up with a scheme that says that once you're done with a spacecraft or a rocket body, you should have no more than 25 years to make sure that that vehicle comes out of orbit. And if you do that, you can drastically curtail the growth of the environment. Second thing you have to do if you're bringing things out of orbit, you need to make sure that you're not harming or putting at risk people and property on the ground. This turned out to be a bigger problem than we had anticipated. Most things are relatively small and they burn up on the way back. But there are a lot of large spacecraft and rocket bodies in which that's not the case. And if we're asking operators to bring them out of orbit, we don't want to create undue risk on the ground. So we set a measure that every individual reentry could not pose a risk to human life anywhere on Earth in excess of 1 in 10,000. So those are pretty good odds until you start to have a lot of reentries. So one of the things that we tried to do is set up some responsible policies. And this actually, we started to set up a jettison, we call a jettison policy for the International Space Station prior to the Columbia accident, because we were starting to accumulate a lot of debris on the space station and we had no way to get rid of it. And even though we were flying the shuttle six times a year, there was just so much being accumulated. And you can see that from some of these pictures here, that it really is starting to become a storage problem on orbit. But we had done our job so well that when we went to the program manager for the International Space Station, he says, well, I can't throw anything off station because NASA orbital debris guidelines won't let me. But in fact, it is okay, because anything which you release from the International Space Station will actually fall back to Earth typically within about 6 weeks. Some will last a little bit longer, but most of the time it falls back to Earth relatively quickly and will burn up. One of the interesting things that we've released, this was last year, it's called SuitSat. It was an old EVA suit. These suits are only designed for use for about 10 times. After that, you have to discard them. And so the astronauts on board the station fill this particular spacesuit with garbage and then just tossed it out the airlock once they were doing an EVA. And it lasted about 7 months before it came back and then burned up harmlessly in orbit. Next. This is an animation. Unfortunately, won't play here. But this is an object which we released this summer. This is called an early ammonia server. So it's really nothing more than a couple of big tanks for thermal control fluid. It's kind of like your air conditioner. You know, whether in your car, in your house, you've got a fluid going through there which is actually removing the heat. Well, we have the same thing on space station. We have to have air conditioners. And we put this extra ammonia on board the space station in the early 2000s in case we had a leak, just like you sometimes have it at your home in your car. And we never had to use it. And it was only designed to be up there for about 5 years. But this instrument, when you can see it's almost the size of an astronaut, actually weighs several hundred pounds. And it was no longer safe to keep it on space station. There was no way to bring it back because we couldn't bring it back in the shuttle for logistics reasons. There was no other vehicle that would be able to bring it back. And so we had to finally this summer just jettison it in a very measured manner. But it took us 3 years to determine that this was the only safe thing to do and how to do it. And it was actually very, very impressive where the astronaut simply grabbed this. Again, it's weightless. It has mass. But an astronaut can grab something which weighs 300 or 400 pounds and actually shove it in a particular direction. And that's exactly what he did here. If it's a very, very large object, then we have to try to bring it in a controlled manner. Because if we didn't, enough components would survive to reach the surface of the Earth that actually may cause harm to somebody or some property. So in 2000, this was one of the rare unmanned robotic spacecraft that we actually did a controlled reentry over the Pacific Ocean. And you'll see these are three snapshots at about 30 seconds apart. And it's some of what you see in some of the science fiction movies now. They do a pretty good job of how the vehicle comes in, starts to look like a comet, starts to heat up. You'll see it then start to break up into lots and lots of little pieces. And we do this, again, in a very controlled manner. So we come down in a part of the Pacific in which there is no habitable land so that whatever does survive will fall harmlessly into the water. Next. The next year, we were involved with the Russians in deorbiting the Mir space station, of course, which was the predecessor to the International Space Station. This was a massive undertaking, very, very large, lots of material which was going to survive and did survive reentry. But again, we did it in a very controlled manner with the Russians and brought it down in the South Pacific, and there was no harm. In January of 1997, a U.S. Delta second stage, a vehicle we've been flying for many, many, many years, came back to Earth, and this is just one of the components which survived reentry. This is a 500-pound tank. This fell in Georgetown, Texas, which is a small town north of Austin in Texas. And this is the picture. I went out to identify the tank to verify it was, in fact, the vehicle we were tracking prior to reentry. And it came down at about the right spot at the right time. We were very confident that this was, in fact, from that upper stage. And so I went out there to identify it. And this is the picture I took that was eventually released by NASA. If you go to the next picture. This is the other side of the vehicle. Looking backwards, it actually came within a couple hundred miles of this gentleman farmer's house. But in all the reentries, of which there have been nearly 20,000 to date, no one in the world has ever been hurt. There's only one case where one lady in Oklahoma, actually during this reentry, got hit by something on the shoulder, which was more like getting hit by a leaf. A very, very unusual event. Most of the debris which survives is relatively dense, relatively heavy, and should it strike you, again, would be a more serious affair. Here's another case we had, again, in Texas. This was a launch of a European unmanned spacecraft out of French Guiana in South America. And it's, in some respects, kind of like our shuttle, except it doesn't have a shuttle attached, but it has a what we would think as the external tank, and it's got two of these strap-on boosters. And at launch, there's a little nose cap right here in which these parachutes are contained. After the boosters burn out, that nose cap is ejected, the parachutes open, and then the boosters can be recovered. Well, this was launched in October of 1998, and then the cap, which this is the one of the caps, actually fell into the Atlantic Ocean, drifted northward, got caught in the currents, went into the Gulf of Mexico, and finally washed ashore on Mustang Island near Corpus Christi in February of 2000. So my wife and I actually went out, examined this. We thought it was potentially space launch related, jotted down some of the serial numbers inside, contacted our French colleagues that confirmed what it was. And it turns out that there is a 1968 UN treaty on the recovery of astronauts and objects launched into space. So under that treaty, if the launching country requests that an object which has been recovered be returned, then we are obligated legally to return that object. Well, it took us several months, about 6 months, before we got the French to say they actually wanted it back. And so that was fine. That was not a problem. So we were working very closely with the State Department to make sure that, you know, we dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. But it turns out that this particular object was taken off the beach by a local there on Mustang Island that was, we'll just say, a little bit eccentric. And what he wanted to do, at least what he was telling the press, what he wanted to do, he wanted to make this a hot tub. And so he just wanted to dig a hole in the ground, put it in there, and make a hot tub. You know, and so that was fine. And he didn't want to give it back. And, you know, the fact that the U.S. was legally obligated under the United Nations Treaty to give it back didn't seem to affect him very much. And so we finally had to go through the State Department and then the Department of Justice to have someone from the Department of Justice call him and impress upon him that he had no choice in the matter. And so finally, after a year, I went down, picked it up, put it on a truck, drove back to the Johnson Space Center in Houston. And so that was now April of 2001. It took us another 3 years before we were able to get that back to France because of all the red tape. It's just unbelievable when you're dealing with some of this equipment and the bureaucracies, not only in Washington, but also the bureaucracies in other countries. Orbital debris has been recognized as a serious enough problem that it's been in the president's national space policy. This is a policy which presidents for many years have released on a wide variety of areas. It includes things like space transportation systems, long-term visions of going back to the moon or Mars. The first time that orbital debris was mentioned was in 1988 by President Reagan. Clinton had his own policy. The latest policy was signed by President Bush last year. And it says, this is one part of the policy applicable to orbital debris, that orbital debris poses a risk to the continued reliable use of space-based services and operations and to the safety of persons and property in space and on Earth. The United States shall seek to minimize the creation of orbital debris by government and non-governmental operations in space in order to preserve space environment for future generations. And then there are other paragraphs which dictate what NASA needs to do, what the Department of Defense needs to do, what other departments do. We have the FCC and the Department of Transportation which regulate spacecraft and launch vehicles. That actually is the force of law for those commercial operators. NASA and DOD are not regulatory agencies, but we operate a large number of spacecraft. We influence the commercial vendors, and so we then either directly or indirectly assure that they follow these guidelines, which we believe are the right thing to do. So what we've done, we've formed interagency working groups within the U.S. government that are normally headed up by the Office of Science and Technology Policy. You're probably all familiar that the president has a science advisor. The president's science advisor actually was a term which started in 1951. In 1976, they established what was called the Office of Science and Technology Policy under the president, but was run by the science advisor and still is. And so the Office of Science and Technology Policy will get together the pertinent U.S. government agencies like NASA, the Department of Defense, the State Department, the FCC, the Department of Transportation, other people with vested interest, the National Security Council. And we attacked the issue of orbital debris and decided what is it that we had to do both domestically and internationally to promote a more responsible use of satellites, both the design, their operation, and the disposal. And so there have been two main reports which have been published, one in 1989 and one in 1995. These are available. They're public documents. Next. Can you go back one? Okay, go forward again. All right, one of the times that we had a very interesting situation at the interagency level, if some of you probably will remember that in the early 90s, mid-90s, all of a sudden there was this great idea that putting a lot of communication satellites into low Earth orbit was going to be a commercially viable operation. And so there were three main constellations. There were many on paper, but three actually got deployed. And one of them was the Iridium constellation, which you probably still hear about occasionally. There are Iridium telephones. And within a span of just 25 months, just over 2 years, 88 spacecraft were launched at a cost of $5.5 billion. It was never been done before. Tremendous investment. 2 months after the last spacecraft was launched in an operation, Motorola Iridium filed for bankruptcy. This is probably a classic story now in business school of what not to do. They had been overcome by technology. There were better alternatives now than putting a lot of satellites into low Earth orbit. But it had taken 5-6 years for Motorola and Iridium to pull this off. And so they had no other choice. They could in no way pay back the $5.5 billion which they had invested and which others had invested. So when they went and filed for bankruptcy, this then went to the Department of Justice because that's the organization which handles bankruptcies. It was a very large bankruptcy. And after about 6 or 7 months, they were prepared to dissolve the Iridium Corporation and to dispose of the assets, which is what you would normally do for a conventional company which goes bankrupt on Earth. But the problem was there were 74 spacecraft which were still in orbit and operational. And the question was, what do you do with these spacecraft? You didn't want to leave them there. As it turns out, one of the chief engineers on the Iridium constellation was a former Air Force officer who had done his master's thesis work at the Air Force Institute of Technology in Dayton on orbital debris. And I knew him quite well. And when he got out of the Air Force, he went to work for Iridium and helped design the vehicle and helped put enough propellant on board to allow those spacecraft to go into a lower orbit at the end of life. They were normally in orbits that would stay there for hundreds of years, literally. But by putting extra propellant on board, they figured at the end of life they could move them down to a lower altitude and they would fall back to Earth within about 2 years. Well, this is great. This is what we had been preaching for many, many years. And here was a commercial organization which had voluntarily gone off and designed their vehicles and built their vehicles to abide by that guideline. So to dispose of the spacecraft, then we had the ability to deorbit, not actually deorbit, but to bring these satellites into a lower orbit to let them fall back to Earth randomly. Well, Iridium had also gone the extra mile and made sure that the reentry risk, which I said earlier was 1 in 10,000, would not be exceeded. However, we were in an interagency meeting headed up by the Department of Justice, because, again, they were in charge. The White House was there and the Department of State and NASA and Defense. And we're talking about getting rid of these satellites. And then you do the math. And the risk for one satellite is 1 in 18,400 that you would hurt somebody. But you have 74 satellites. So you multiply by 74. And it turns out that the risk that someone might get hurt was now 1 in 250 if you brought them all down. And so I'm sitting next to an assistant attorney general of the United States who is responsible for worrying about, you know, the rate of acquiring cancer if you live near a Superfund site, you know, a toxic waste. And they think in terms of 1 in a million, you know, and we come back and we say, hey, if we bring all these down, the risk of hurting somebody somewhere in the world is now 1 in 250. And you know, this, you know, their eyes glaze over, and they just don't want to do this. And it turned out, being scientists and engineers, we found a way to actually reduce that risk. Unfortunately, what it would do we could make all these satellites come down in the southern hemisphere. But we couldn't say exactly where, but we could make it the southern hemisphere. We were smart enough to do that, you know. But the State Department guys in the room were saying, no, that's not, you know, that's not going to fly. If it gets out that all of a sudden we're putting our, you know, South American or African friends at risk and, you know, protecting, you know, Europe and North America. So actually it turned out there was a happy ending to the story. It turned out that somebody came up and offered to buy the constellation. And I told you it cost $5.5 billion to deploy. They bought the whole constellation lock, stock, and barrel for $25 million. And on top of that, they got a commitment from the Department of Defense to be their primary user for several years. So they automatically bought into a profit-making organization. Of course, the investors in Iridium, you know, were out all of their initial investment. So this is where the Dilbert cartoon comes in. Actually, this Dilbert cartoon came out in the middle of our evaluations, and the work that I did on the reentry risk actually didn't come out for almost a year later when someone put in a request for Freedom of Information Act to find out the actual analysis that we did. And I don't know if you can read it back there or not, but the boss for Dilbert is saying, you know, we'll be shutting down our global communication systems and deorbiting all the satellites. And then Dilbert's saying, well, yes, won't that create dozens of deadly flame balls speeding toward Earth? And then the pointy-haired boss come back and say, well, that's why we're targeting cities with lots of swimming pools. There was a lot, unfortunately, a lot more truth to that than was known at the time. One of the things that came out of the 1989 interagency report on orbital debris, which is the very first one, was that the White House directed NASA to go communicate with our fellow agencies in other parts of the world to teach them, you know, the gospel of orbital debris mitigation. And so we did that, and we set up a lot of bilateral meetings. We had a bilateral working group with Russia, a bilateral working group with Europeans, a bilateral working group with Japan. And after a few years, you know, this was just getting a little tedious and a lot of extra work. So we said, why don't we just set up an international organization called the Interagency Space Debris Coordination Committee. And if for some reason we abbreviated IADC, which is something that we'll regret to our dying day because no one can understand why it's only IADC. But it's been a very, very effective organization. It's an intergovernmental group made up only of space agencies. It's grown from 4 members to 11 members. We have 10 countries plus the European Space Agency, of course, which represents a lot of countries of its own. And those countries and organizations are listed here. We primarily exchange technical data and research information on orbital debris. But we've done a few other things as well. I, for the last 10 years, have led the U.S. delegation. It's technically a NASA delegation, but on my delegation, I have representatives from NASA, from the Department of Defense, from the State Department, from the FCC, because these are all important players in the United States government dealing with space operations and, again, of course, orbital debris. One of the things we did in the late 1990s was decide we needed to come up with international consensus guidelines like NASA had. We had already developed them. Not only we took them from NASA and we got U.S. government guidelines, we got all U.S. government agencies to sign off on them. We now want to take it one step further into the international community. So by October 2002, we had completed this first set of guidelines, and you go to the web and pull them down. They look very, very much like the NASA guidelines. Those, I simplified the 4 bullets earlier, but same basic concepts. Everybody agreed. Once you explain the issues of orbital debris and you explain how you can prevent new orbital debris, then most people are on board. The guidelines are actually voluntary. And the first thing people will say is, well, if they're voluntary, you know, that's not good because no one's going to follow them. But it turns out that's not been the case, at least not in space and not in orbital debris, because spacecraft manufacturers and operators and launch vehicle manufacturers and operators have a vested interest in the continued utility of space. So if you go to them and say, hey, here's a problem, and here's a cost-effective solution, it's been amazing how quickly they have jumped on board. Just like I said earlier with the Iridium constellation, they did a lot of things that no one made them do, but they were the responsible thing to do, and you know they understand this just as well as government agencies. So we've been very fortunate in the IADC. And then the next step, and this was all actually part of a strategy developed at the U.S. government level, of saying, okay, once we get the 11 major players at IADC to agree to this, we need to take it to the United Nations next. So next slide. The United Nations has an organization called the Office of Outer Space Affairs. Up until the early 1990s, this was headquartered at the UN headquarters in New York. It then was transferred to Vienna and remains in Vienna today. And under the Office of Outer Space Affairs, and actually an organization within the UN, if you go to the next slide, is something you may have well have heard of. It's called the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. Anything that's really space-related in the UN goes into this committee. And it has two subcommittees. One's a legal subcommittee, and one is the scientific and technical subcommittee. Well, in 1994, the topic of orbital debris was placed on the agenda under the Scientific and Technical Subcommittee. And we meet every February in Vienna, and we discuss the issues associated with orbital debris. And for the first several years of what we call a multi-year work plan, we basically collected data and developed a report, which was the sort of the accumulation of all world knowledge on orbital debris and what the extent was and how fast was it growing and what were the potential hazards. And we developed that through 1996 through 1999. And we produced a report which was a pretty significant achievement in and of itself. It's a relatively long report. We have to, in the UN, develop everything in the six official languages of the United Nations. And when you're putting a report together, everything in the subcommittee and in the committee has to be by consensus. So in the subcommittee, you have about 60 different countries represented. And you have to go through a report literally sentence by sentence in six different languages and get everybody to agree to every word. This is a lesson in patience. This is very, very difficult. And you're arguing with people, you know, for which English language is not their primary language, on the meaning of English language words or grammar, you know, where do you place the comma? And this is why things take so long in the United Nations. So actually we were pretty proud of ourselves though in 1999 and said, okay, we've got this report out here. Well, now what do we do next? So we came back in February of 2000, and we couldn't agree. We had four different countries come in with four completely different plans on where to go from here. So in December of 2000, we had about 15 countries meet in Berlin to try to come up offline of where we go from here. And the United States made a proposal that says, okay, well, the IADC is currently trying to produce these guidelines. Let's let them do that. Let's let the IADC then present them to the UN, and we'll let the UN sign off of them, and then we will achieve what we'd set out to do. So we finished that at the IADC, completed the guidelines in October 2002, and in February of 2003, we very proudly, with our IADC hats on, presented them to the UN, and they were not as well received as we thought they would be. And in fact, the biggest surprise was, the biggest detractor was the Russian Federation. And the Russian Federation had already agreed to them in the IADC, you know, just a few months earlier. But now in the UN, their position was, well, the Russian Space Agency had agreed to them. The Russian government hadn't agreed to them. And so some of the things which had the Russians had not been able to include into the guidelines in the IADC, which we basically talked them out of, they now wanted another opportunity to do it in the UN. And so we spent 2 years in the UN and decided there was no way forward. And so we came up with another option in which we were going to develop our own guidelines in the UN. So it turns out these are the same technical guys who developed the IDC guidelines. But now we have our national hats on in the UN, and we started to develop new UN guidelines, which we did in February of this year, adopted at the subcommittee level, and then formally adopted at the committee level in June of this year. And there are now UN guidelines for space debris mitigation, which apply or encourage to apply to all nations of the world. And you know, this is where we are. It's still voluntary, but again, we've had very, very good success in countries adopting these and following through with them. Until January of this year, as I think many of you are aware, in January, China tested an anti-satellite system. There have been no anti-satellite tests by anybody for over 20 years. The United States and the Soviet Union had gotten out of, and now Russia Federation, had gotten out of that business. We knew it was destabilizing. We knew there were a lot of other problems associated with it, not the least of which was orbital debris. And so we had not done it. China, for its own reasons, decided they needed to have an anti-satellite system. And so they took an existing weather satellite, which was nearing the end of its life, and they launched a ballistic missile toward it and intercepted it, much like we did with the F-15 system back in the mid-1985 time period. And they created the largest debris cloud ever. This is not a laughing matter. We are tracking today over 2,500 large objects. We are estimating there are at least 35,000 pieces which are at least 1 centimeter in diameter. So that's about 4/10 of an inch. Any satellite being hit by any of those particles will almost certainly be destroyed. So this is a very serious issue. Unfortunately, they also conducted the experiment at a very high altitude in low Earth orbit. The debris here, as the last bullet says, some of it will be up there for hundreds of years. All of it will be up there for decades. And so we've already had to maneuver at NASA. We've had to maneuver a spacecraft to avoid a very potential collision. There's another U.S. satellite which has had to maneuver to avoid a collision. We were preparing to have to maneuver the International Space Station on one occasion earlier this year. But fortunately, just before we did the maneuver, the new projections had the piece of debris going a little bit farther away from the station than we had originally anticipated, so we didn't have to do the maneuver. But this is actually a very, very serious problem. I have another animation, but it's probably not going to work. Initially, all the debris is looks like a ring. And actually, very quickly, because altitudes change, it looks like a disc, kind of like a CD. All the debris is, you can think about going around on the CD. But then, as time goes on, in this case just weeks or months, it starts to spread out. And what happens now, if this were to be, if the animation were to work, you would see that as of today, which is now about 10 months after the event, we have this ring now almost completely encompassing the Earth. Again, it's a threat to every single operational spacecraft in LEO, which is over 400 spacecraft. It's only a matter of time before one spacecraft gets hit by that debris. I've had 3 occasions to talk with the Chinese since January, in Vienna, in France, and in India a couple weeks ago. And it's simply a case of the people who were conducting the experiment didn't understand what was going to happen. There are experts in China, my counterpart in China, that understands, you know, what's going to happen in this kind of an event. They didn't ask his opinion. And they are now, although they're very sensitive about it, they are aware of the magnitude of what they've done. We're relatively cautiously optimistic that they won't do it again. We have in the guidelines, both at the UN and IDC, and even in the United States, that you can conduct certain tests of this nature. But you have to do it at a very, very low altitude. so the debris only lasts a few weeks or a few months. And that was the problem the Chinese had. They did it at a very high altitude. So this is what will happen to the Earth environment. Let me try and describe it for you. This is the only technical chart I've got. This is the growth of the satellite population during the last 50 years. These are large objects in low Earth orbit. So we have about 8,000 currently. If we were to stop launching all spacecraft right now, never launch another thing, the population would pretty much stabilize for about 30, 40, 50 years. This was before the Chinese test, so it's a little bit worse now. And then what would happen is that objects currently in orbit, some would start to fall back, and some of the explosion fragments which were up there would start to fall back. But after a while, you know, all what we call the low-hanging fruit, all the things which are relatively low altitude, which will come back within the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years will come back, and then it will level out because everything else has lifetimes of hundreds and thousands of years. But the red curve, this is the growth of the environment just due to collisions between things which are already up there. So after, in this particular case, by about 2050, the population starts climbing again, even though we never launched another satellite. And that will continue. And there's no way to avoid that unless we can come up with some method of actually removing old satellites and old rocket bodies. It's something we've looked into for many, many years. We have not yet found a concept, a technique, which is both technically feasible and economically viable. You know, it doesn't make any sense to spend $50 million to go up there and retrieve one old rocket body. So we've got to find some way to bring down that mass that we can afford and will do an effective job of curtailing the environment. So this is the position we're in right now. We're working on it to try and mitigate the growth of the environment by preventing future explosions and collisions to the best of our ability. That will be a great near-term solution, but it's not a far-term solution. And then finally, if we fail to curtail the growth of the environment, then you're going to have, again, a pollution problem not unlike that of air and water, where you won't be able to operate in space. You will not be able to operate your communication satellites, your navigation satellites, your weather forecasting satellites. This is a long time in the future, but it is a potential future scenario if you don't do things differently than how we do it today. So the challenge that we currently have, again, is to identify economically acceptable. You know, we can't ask manufacturers to spend twice what they're currently spending to build a spacecraft just to make sure that it won't create debris. We've got to find that some method, which we have been, which are as much more cost effective, and implement these mitigation practices, and virtually everybody has to do it. It doesn't do any good if only the United States and only Japan are doing this. There are a lot of other players in space now. Everybody has to be on board. And so finally, the alternative, of course, is that we give our offspring, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, a problem which then may be much, much more dire than what we have to do today. So again, I appreciate your attention, and I appreciate the opportunity to come down and talk to you about orbital debris, and thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Sure. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you so much for coming out today. My question is in regards to the Van Allen belts.
Yeah.
And what effects they might have on orbital debris, as you talked about in your lecture.
The radiation belts actually have no effect on orbital debris. The worst thing they do is they can actually, for small debris, induce a charge on a small particle, and that will have a very, very minor perturbation effect. But it doesn't have a net effect that would, say, bring it back to Earth more quickly or alternatively put it into a higher orbit. So the radiation belts is something we worry about for human spaceflight, and sometimes components of spacecraft, but in terms of orbital debris, there really is no connection. Yes, sir.
I was curious about the issue of spy satellites, particularly when you negotiate agreements internationally that different countries opt to stay secret. They don't want to discuss what they have up in orbit.
Right. That's a true statement.
Yes. And as far as orbital debris is concerned, there is a potential problem. Is that how do you navigate that issue and deal with it?
Well, the way we handle that is that it's not important what mission the satellite is performing. And we made that very, very clear through all our guidelines, both at the national level and international level. We don't care what the mission is. We don't care what altitude you fly at. We don't care if it's a big satellite or a small satellite. If everybody, regardless of their size and altitude and mission, follows the guidelines that we've established, then everything is fine. And so you don't have to declare what you're doing. There aren't very many real secrets anymore about what spacecraft are doing, even though sometimes we don't talk about them as much as other spacecraft. But they're really, we've been able to bring on board what we call the national systems from all countries, the United States, Russian Federation, of course, and to a lesser extent China, operate most of the so-called defense systems. But they're playing by the same rules we are, so we're very pleased with that. Yes, ma'am. Well, we've been looking at it, and actually there is a professional organization called the International Academy of Astronautics. It's the 2,000 top space weenies, if you will, in the world. And we have started up a study last year to look at what I alluded to earlier of what kind of methods could we apply to bring both large debris and small debris out of orbit, because remediating the environment is really where we now want to go, because our recent analysis says that we just can't leave well enough alone. Even though we're not having a serious risk to the current operations in the future, that's not going to be the case. So we're looking at different concepts. They range from using directed energy systems on the ground, like lasers or particle beams, to perturb the orbit of satellites so they put them in orbits that will come back quicker. There's the classic garbage scow, which goes up and latches onto an old derelict rocket body or spacecraft and then brings it back into the atmosphere. Although, again, that's kind of like a lot of money for bringing out one object. There's another extreme is we also want to get rid of some of the small debris. One of the interesting concepts, although not really viable, is put up like a Nerf ball 1 mile in diameter. What will happen is there's so many small debris, those debris will hit the Nerf ball and go right through it. But in that process, they will lose energy and they will drop into a lower orbit and they'll come back to Earth more quickly. So if you did this in extreme, you actually could remove debris. And we've thought about doing something similar like in front of a space station. Have it run out interference up front and have it deflect things. But the problem with that is the Nerf ball would fall back to Earth itself very quickly because it's very, very light. And Nerf balls are non-discriminatory. A mile diameter Nerf ball could run into an operational spacecraft and destroy it. So there are a lot of interesting concepts. There are a lot of concepts with tethers. You may or may not have heard about 2 weeks ago, the Europeans tried to deploy a tether from a Russian spacecraft. They advertised it as trying to come up with a space mail delivery system. Tether didn't work right. And in fact, there's an unfortunate history of tethers over the last 15 years in which practically every tether experiment has failed one way or the other. But if we ever know how to do tethers right, it actually has the potential for solving a lot of our problems. You can put tethers on existing rocket bodies or spacecraft or old ones which are already up there, and you can probably bring them down cost effectively. The problem is developing that system and figuring out how to attach them and how to bring them down reliably with a high success rate. So we're thinking very, very hard. Our study will be completed probably in early 2009, and we hope to just lay out you know, all the concepts that anybody has ever thought of and grade them and say which ones are feasible and which ones might be near-term solutions. I'll tell you what the answer is probably going to be right now, is there's no system in the near term. But if there's a significant improvement in technology, which is certainly possible, if there's a significant reduction of launch costs, which we keep hoping for and working toward but never seem to achieve, that will then make some of these concepts we look at in the past look a little bit more attractive. But right now, to be perfectly candid, it's sort of grim. We just don't know how to do it.
Yes, sir.
Thank you again for showing. In the last part of your speech, you focused on China. And my question related to China in two aspects. Firstly, given the fact that the U.S. and Russia have developed the same space program for the past 50 years, how do you respond to China's argument that it is unfair to expect China to adopt the now stricter standard that the West has proposed? And secondly, since the U.S. has given up the anti-satellite program a long time ago, what do you think the motivation for the Chinese space program is? And do you see potential military or political threats to the U.S. interest?
Okay, let me tackle both those very good questions. I think you're all familiar with the 1997 Kyoto Accord on climate change. There was an interesting concept which developed out of that protocol, which said that developed countries have a higher responsibility than developing countries. And it's been a concept which actually has crept up the UN the last several years, where some countries, particularly third world countries, want to apply that same concept to orbital debris. And I think, kind of going along with what you said, say, well, the United States and Russia, because we have created most of the debris which currently exists, which is a true statement, and we have the largest constellation of spacecraft, that we have a higher responsibility to cleaning up the environment. And third world countries, be it China or India or whomever, need to give a pass for a decade or two and not have to implement these same restrictions. Fortunately, in the UN, we've been able to avoid that. It's come up. We've had nations mention that principle, but as evidenced by the guidelines adopted at the UN this year, there are no conditions in there. There are no special loopholes for developing countries. So China, which is a member of the Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, as well as a member of the IADC, has signed up to this. They have pledged to follow the guideline just like everybody else, as has India, Japan, and other major spacefaring countries. So it's really not as much of a problem as we thought it might be. You never know what's going to happen next year. But right now, most of the guidelines, again, are not that difficult to implement. We're not asking people to do things which are going to dramatically, cost more in their overall programs or make spacecraft hard to design and operate. The second part of your question is basically why did the Chinese conduct an ASAT test? I mean, you probably get a lot of different answers to that, and I'm not sure that anyone outside of the Chinese government really know why they did what they did. Clearly, the United States and the Russian Federation have tremendous capabilities in space. There are other organizations, international organizations like ESA and Japan and to a lesser extent Israel or India, which have capabilities. If you think about potential future conflicts on Earth, having an ability to negate an enemy spacecraft can look attractive. I used to do these war games, 25, 30 years ago. It's not a fair fight sometimes. For example, if you think back the way it was in the 1980s, the United States had relatively few very high-valued satellites. The Russians, the Soviets then, had a large number of satellites, were short-lived, but which they could replace quickly. So if you ever get into a real space war, you know, you can't play tit for tat. You know, if they were to shoot down one of our reconnaissance satellites, you know, we could shoot down one of their reconnaissance satellites, but the effect would be tremendously different. We would be much more hurt because we only had a couple. They had many. We saw them actually launch replacements within days of losing a satellite for whatever reason, which is, you know, incomprehensible to the way the United States works. So China has relatively few Earth orbital assets, particularly of a defense nature. It does have some. So if there were ever to be a space war, which hopefully there will not, you would see that there would be some advantage to them. They have a lot less to lose during a space war than, say, the United States or the Russian Federation. So, again, I don't want to get into specific scenarios, but clearly there are some scenarios which the Chinese are thinking about that this might be attractive. Now, on the other hand, you also have to be careful. This was a test. It remains to be seen whether or not this becomes a deployed system. You know, the United States did one test of its own in 1985. We never did deploy the system. The reason we didn't deploy it is because Congress forbid it. After the first test, they never let us test again. And after a few years, we simply abandoned the program. You can't have a weapon system if you can't test it. And the Soviet Union came to basically the same conclusion. But since the Chinese test, the bad thing has been that several countries in the world now are rethinking their positions. There is a philosophy is you don't want to have significant asymmetries to exist. So having one country with anti-satellite capability is not necessarily good for world politics and world stability. And so the question now is, what's going to happen next? If the Chinese never test again, you know, it'll be a one-shot operation, literally, and people will probably eventually, you know, calm down again. If we see additional tests, you're probably going to see reactions from several different countries, which would not necessarily be a good thing.
We have time for more questions.
Okay.
Thank you very much for coming. I just wonder if you could briefly talk a little bit more about the technology we use to track this orbital debris. I was amazed by the size that we're capable of tracking. Where are these installations and how do they work?
All right. Most of the tracking is done by what's called the U.S. Space Surveillance Network. It's primarily composed of very large radars, the old dish radars, and what were called, if you remember that one picture there was looked like the side of a barn. It's called a phased array radar. It steers electronically instead of mechanically. But these radars are primarily positioned around the United States periphery. They were designed and originally built and maintained to give us missile warning. Back in the old days, they fall under the NORAD organization. So in the old days, if the Soviet Union were to launch a strike, these radars would detect those missiles coming in, and we would do whatever reaction that was appropriate. Those same radars, you know, they've been up there for 40 years now, haven't detected a single missile coming toward the United States, which is a good thing. But they need to be used every day to make sure they're ready if called upon. So they spend most of their time actually tracking debris in space. One of the other reasons why they started doing it originally was they had to distinguish between something they knew was in orbit already and something new which had just arrived and maybe heading toward the United States. And so we operate these sensors. We have radars at other parts of the globe, but the majority are either in the continental United States or on U.S. territory. We have a radar in England, in Greenland. We have some on a few islands. Those are primarily used for low altitude up to about 5,000 kilometers. They're very sensitive. Those radars can typically see things down to 4 inches in diameter at several hundred miles. We have other radars, which are higher frequency, very specialized radars that NASA operates with or without the cooperation of DOD, that can see things, again, down to like a tenth of an inch. We can't track them. We don't know where they're going to be tomorrow, but the advantage is that we can track them in such a manner that we can develop what's called a statistical assessment of the environment. So if we stare in one location for X period of time and we see Y number of particles going through, we can do a quick calculation and say, well, for that to happen, there has to be Z number of particles already out there. And so that tells us what the environment is, whether it's growing, whether it's diminishing, staying the same, or whatever. For a very high altitude, radars are not necessarily the best answer, and we use telescopes, optical telescopes, electro-optical telescopes. Back in the old days, we used to use telescopes with photographic film, but we've certainly gotten away from that, just like your normal camera has gotten away from that. We have digital cameras. But the downside of that is objects at a very far distance have to be larger for us to be able to see. So typically at geosynchronous altitudes where most of the commsats are, we can only see things about a meter in diameter. We're trying with some special techniques to get that down to maybe a tenth of that. But again, we can't see the very, very small debris. However, we believe there's probably not as much very small debris because there haven't been as many events which would have generated small debris there. So we have that system. It's the best in the world. The Russians have a similar system, not quite as capable. And we're the only ones right now which actually maintain catalogs. The Europeans are thinking about deploying a similar system, but that's probably a good 5-10 years down the road at the earliest.
Yes, sir.
Thank you again for coming today. While you were talking about the orbital debris, I was thinking about an analogy with the air traffic control and how controllers on the ground had to direct the airplanes so that they would avoid hitting each other or so that they wouldn't be within 3 miles of each other. So on and so forth. So it seems that NASA has focused on a very ground-based type system. Now, I know you can't really say, you're not really moving around satellites in space, but you can move the space shuttle, for example. And I was wondering if you had worked on any sort of cockpit-based solution to avoiding orbital debris.
All right, let me answer that in two ways. The answer to your last real question was, no, we can't. We tried that. The problem is, and we looked at this very hard in the early 90s before we launched the space station, an idea was to have something on the space station, a radar or some sensor, that would see debris coming. And then we could, you know, jump out of the way or do whatever we might need to do. The problem is that the closing velocities are about, as I said, at that altitude, about 7 miles per second. So if you're really, really good, you might see a detectable piece of debris, you know, 70 miles away. All right? 70 miles away, it's going 7 miles per second, doesn't take long to get to you. And you have no time to react. You know, you can't put up shields like they do in Star Trek. And so we found out that even if we could detect it, and it turns out even detecting it is very, very difficult, we couldn't do anything about it. So we kind of pushed that aside and said we just don't have to live with the situation as it exists and try to make sure it doesn't get any worse. Now, what you talked about in the very beginning, you talked about air traffic control. There is a concept which has been in vogue the last few years called space traffic management. Right now, anybody can fly anywhere they want in orbit. There are really no restrictions with the exception of geosynchronous orbit. And so people feel that, you know, that's kind of like the old horse and buggy days. That's got to come to an end. You have to have traffic cops in space. But there are no good analogies between air traffic control and, you know, ground transportation control and sea transportation control because the physics are different. You can't stop in space. You can't do a right angle turn in space. And it turns out it's a very, very difficult problem. It's one that we're addressing at the international level, but we don't see any near-term solutions. There are a lot of people who think they want to jump right into it. In fact, there are people that want to create international space traffic management organizations without understanding what they would do. It sounds like a good idea. And eventually, maybe we'll have something like that, but probably not anytime in the near term, just because the challenges are just so, so severe. All right.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, thank you. Yeah, appreciate your time. Thank you.